Oh, and I never saw a blizzard, and haven't yet. The accidental, this whole landscape, of course, was constructed. It wasn't something I had was remembering. Similar kind of thing occurs, I wrote Omen Setter's Luck, and people notice that I grew up in Ohio, and the story takes place in something called Gillian, a river town in Ohio, and they said, aha, of course, he grew up in this river town, and he's now spilling his guts about his, you know, life there. But of course, I grew up in a steel town. I hardly ever got to the river. The only stream I saw was a muddy old drainage ditch called the Mahoning, and so on. I had nothing to do. Indeed, I put the stories always someplace where I didn't have any idea, because I didn't want to have the reality of things interfering with the construction of the language. Now, I think that this happens all the time. It's not, I think, unusual. Consequently, for example, as some people said, well, he's a Midwestern writer, but I think that I'm no more a Midwestern writer, maybe even a writer, than Thomas Mann is the muse of St. Louis. I mean, it's a pure accident. It's a matter of a few names, and that's all. Let me give you an example of what I mean by this, which I think is a phenomenon which is so widespread that most writers will confess to it if you press them on it. A passage again from Omen Setter, again about the preacher in his garden, which is sort of crumbling into decay. And here he goes out and sort of talks to himself, saying, and now I'm going to tell them about the devil, and I'm going to say this on Sunday, and so on. He had his rehearsals here. Slowly, his head bowed, the Bible held firmly against his chest, he would circle the garden. His eyes would sweep over the ground near his feet, over the bruised leaves and bared roots, the grass stubble, and the mud that oozed between stones. Lilies of the valley grew thickly near the wall, where trails of crumbled mortar, smears of river damp and moss were visible under the vines. Violets, chickweed, and the buckhorn plantain flourished. There was privet still alive from a feeble attempt before his time to divide the garden with hedges, and a rose which the wind burned to the ground every winter sprawled over a rotting willow stump, its canes nearly leafless from disease, struggling to bloom. Chafers would feed upon the buds, yet he would stay his hand, verifying once again the destructive course of nature. Orange-yellow when it flowered, it was a climber, and he thought he recognized its fragrance. A neighbor of his mother grew it, or she had, like a dream of gold along her fence, Revdor. And golden honeysuckle up the trellis of her porch, with strident morning glories too, and clematis as purple as the robe of a king. And there were pearl-white lily trumpets, forsythia and lilacs like so many fountains, 4 o'clocks and bleeding heart, begonias spilling out of baskets swung from chains, straw flowers, daisies, pink hydrangeas that she sometimes fertilized with nails to make them blue, weedy magenta phlox and columbine, verbena, floppy red petunias, bachelor buttons, zinnias, round transparent pennyroyal to dry and press beneath the palms, psalms. Rose geraniums in pots along the rails, gentians, pinks, sweet peas, nasturtiums of the clearest orange. He peered at all this thick, sweet beauty through the pickets, frightened somewhat, for they kept a dog, and at the rough, sweet lawn, so cool and moist, the walk around it edged with snowy ageratum and violet alyssum, pansies pink as lips, stonecrop squeezing between the bricks, while in the beds behind them there were sky-blue asters on hooping stems, pale and methodical, as perfect as if they had been grown by spiders. And hidden by high grass and goldenrod and stock, he would watch the woman, Mrs. Kermit Hazen. Maisie, was it? Did she live beyond her operation? Fidel was the dog. Stretching her garish yellow print across her rump and showing the roll of her stockings when she bent to cut the stems and pile the flowers in her dusty apron. Tears would form in his eyes, running the figures of the flowers and the woman together, and he would press the fence slats cruelly into his cheeks. She'd have planted marigolds nearby, and through the fence he would reach one, uprooting it roughly, and rubbing his face with its pungent leaves, before he went into the house and gave his cheek to his aunt to kiss so she would sneeze. Now, a passage like that might say, oh, what an interest he has in flowers. But no, of course, again, obviously no interest in flowers in particular, no particular special interest. Rather an interest in the names for flowers, which were accumulated and played with long after the readers gotten sick and tired of this long list of flowers. We'll go on about that and so on. But the author isn't interested. He's building something out of these names for flowers, and the reader will just have to go to sleep or put the book down or patiently wade through the flowers like the Burpee catalog in order to get to the other side of it. Now, what's disastrous, it seems to me, is when somebody's life tends to correspond with the words they use, which is natural enough, because their life for a writer means nothing more than the accumulation of a vocabulary. A Conrad goes out and he's a sea captain. Great, it gives him a nice vocabulary so that when he begins to write his stories, naturally, he will choose to write in a language he knows. But just to suppose that because the language is there, you can infer something, one of the best examples of this, one of the most beautiful sets of lists, and I'd be fond of making lists. Again, not because I'm interested in the things on them, because I'm interested in the names for the things. Things don't matter, they're unimportant. Names are everything that matters. One of the finest passages in all of contemporary literature is a passage in Stanley Elkin's The Bad Man, where he's having Feldman look over the store that he runs and account here floor after floor of all this stuff that's for sale. It is, I recommend to him, one of the really great things reminds me, as another passage, similar passage, reminds me of a list of things in Ben Jonson's Alchemist. And I think that the motivation is very much the same. Ben Jonson liked words too. The more the merrier, and the more odd, and so on. Tried. And that's the interest. Not in things, not in ideas separated from language. Ideas, fine. Any old idea. I mean, Joyce loved ideas. He picked them up like a jackdaw, picks up bright things, carried them home to his nest. So that into his books he pours ideas. But he doesn't have, I think, any particular interest in ideas in terms of their truth, but as organizing systems of meanings, or already organized systems of meanings. Now, symbols themselves, of course, are arbitrary with respect to their meanings. That is, there's nothing particularly sacred about the connection between a sound like moon and the moon. In fact, the more you think about it, the more obviously ridiculous it becomes. Of course, among other things the writer has to do is to make that not seem ridiculous. But there's also, of course, then between words as a whole, or any symbol and things, this absurd relationship. And what's strange about a writer, I think, is that he begins to get more interested in the words, the symbols, than in the things they're symbols of. Consequently begins to get upset when people move, as you would ordinarily expect them to do, from namely what is said to what, I mean, the words to what's meant. And after all, they're symbols. They're supposed to be symbols. What is the meaning of the symbol? A brief example of this, from Omen Setter, the minister is thinking about just this. And I think this is the danger of getting into the aesthetic attitude Henry James explored so beautifully, what happens when you start treating people as works of art, because it's an immoral treatment, it's okay as long as it's words. It would be futile to say as a man, I don't matter. He's thinking about himself as the preacher representing the church and so on. He says, I don't matter. But remember what I mean. For the body of every symbol is absurd. Tell me, how did Jesus pee? Who will preach on this point? Who will address himself to this question? Did he? Oh, yea, sisters and brothers, he did. He peed the same as you do. Certainly the same. Fully as well, too. yea, fully as often. A pale, straw-yellow stream. It's more likely he was circumcised than he was wispy-bearded, weakly blonde, girl whiskerless, a boy at 20, though a man at 10, a carpenter, each inch a king. He was, in sum, an ordinary son of God, the average kind, in all ways pious, meek, contentious, thin. Food wedged in his teeth, for instance, his skin blistered, empty, his belly rumbled, stones cut his feet. Consider a moment the chemistry of the Last Supper. And when hung on the cross between the thieves, he felt no differently the kiss of his nails than they did theirs. I can assure you of that much. Happy to do so, sisters. Happy. So happy, brothers. So much, too, you're this God's equal. He made his wind like anyone. His buttocks coughed, and I can imagine he was tempted, relieving himself, to spatter the spider who'd bit him. His body made him humble, yet he was piss-proud. What sense to say he had one otherwise? What sense? But futile. Yea, brothers, bombity-bast. They've scrubbed him, drained his fluids, wiped up his colors, ironed out his creases. Beautiful Jesus, the embalmer's pride. Now that's what happens, I think, in literature if you forget the physical bearer of the symbol. Now you can, of course, however you may be trying to contrive your effects, surprise yourself with something that pops out, which is unexpected, in which, in a sense, you find out something about yourself. But by and large, by the time you're working through this kind of thing, the relationship between yourself and the medium and the problem and all the rest of the things that are involved, the fact that, of course, you are not the pure artist, as I'm talking about, but also relieving your feelings and trying to make a present of them, as if to suppose that your defecations are beautiful, and here, mother, aren't you happy, that kind of thing. But also, of course, manipulating your audience. You're doing all these things at once, and you're trying, whether you want to or not, and you're trying to work them together. Consequence is that a straightforward expression of what really is in you is very unlikely. So when it happens, it can come as somewhat a shock. I want to mention one brief passage in which that happened to me, in which I thought I was on top of the material. I thought that I was quite safe. There was a section from the story called In the Heart of the Heart of the Country, which is written in these brief paragraphs with little labels. This one was called Education. And in this paragraph, which I was trying to manipulate in a certain musical way, a number of juxtapositions, all kinds of little complex devices, which would hide, of course, from myself. Since I was concentrating on technical problems, my real self could sneak in the back way where I wasn't paying any attention, I suppose. In this passage, the narrator was evidently once a teacher, was thinking about the education that goes on in the small town, and then about his own students, which he once had, and then about his next-door neighbor, Mrs. Desmond, who's an old lady who keeps dropping in for tea and who can't hear a thing he says, and he wishes she'd go away, and so on. Buses, like great orange animals, move through the early light to school. There the children will be taught to read and warned against communism by Miss Janet Jakes. That's not her name. Her name is Helen something, Scott or James. A teacher 20 years. She's now worn fine and smooth and has a face, Wilfred says, like a mail-order axe. Her voice is hoarse and she has a cough, for she screams abuse. The children stare, their faces blank. This is the 13th week. They are used to it. You will all, she shouts, you will all draw pictures of me. No, she's a missus, someone's missus. And in silence they set to work while Miss Jakes jabs hairpins in her hair. Wilfred says an axe, but she has those rimless tinted glasses, graying hair, and almost dimpled chin. I must concentrate. I must stop making up things. I must give myself to life. Let it mold me. That's what they say in Wisdom's Monthly Digest every day. Enough, enough, you've been at it long enough. And the children rise formally a row at a time to present their work to her desk. No, she wears rims. It's her chin that's dimpleless. Well, it will take more than a tablespoon of features to sweeten that face. So she grimly shuffles their sheets, examines her reflection crayoned on them. I would not dare allow a child to put a line around me. Though now and then she smiles like a nick in the blade, in the end these drawings depress her. I could not bear it. How can she ask that anyone draw me? Her anger's lit. That's why she does it. Flame. There go her eyes. The pink in her glasses brightens, dims. She's a pumpkin, and her rage is breathing like the candle in. No, she shouts, no. The cartoon trembling. No, John Mauch, John Stuart Mauch, this will not do. The picture flutters from her hands. You've made me too muscular. I work on my poetry. I remember my friends, associates, my students by their names. Their names are Maypop, Dormouse, Upsidaisy. Their names are Gladiolus, Callow Bladder, Princes and Princess, Oleo, Hieronymus, Cardinal Mum-Mum, Mr. Fishu, the Silken Howdah, Spot. Sometimes you're Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry Finn. It is perpetually summer. Your buttocks are my pillow. We are adrift on a raft. Your back is our river. Sometimes you're Major Barbara, sometimes a goddess who kills men in battle. Sometimes you are soft like a shower of water. You are bread in my mouth. I do not work on my poetry. I forget my friends, associates, my students, and their names. Gramophone, blowgun, pickle, serenade, Marge the Barge, Arena, Uberhaupt, Dr. Dildo, the fog machine. For I am now in B in Indiana, out of job and out of patience, out of love and time and money, out of bread and out of body, in a temper, Mrs. Desmond, out of tea. So shut your fist up, bitch, you bag of death. Go bang another door. Go die, my dearie. Die, life deaf old lady. Spill your breath. Fall over like a frozen board. Gray hair grows from the nose of your mind. You are a skull already, a memento mori. The foreskin retracts from your teeth. Will your plastic gums last longer than your bones and color their grinning? And is your twat still hazel hairy, or are you as bald as a ditch? Bitch. 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 I wanted to be famous, but you bring me age, my emptiness. Was it that which I thought would balloon me above the rest? Love, where are you? Love me. I want to rise so high, I said, that when I shit, I won't miss anybody. That last line came as a surprise. I thought I had everything else calculated. And I looked at it, wondering, is that what you really think? And I decided that was what I really thought. The thing that's difficult, however, is that that kind of line can appear in a passage in which, say, it's a genuine kind of sudden burst, and which can surprise its author and in a sense reveal himself to himself. But it can look, in every other respect, like a lot of other lines. The fact that it sort of loud or something of the sort, strident, doesn't mean that it wasn't just like everything else. So it is very hard in advance to tell when something is constructed and when it is not. When it's revealing of the author and when it isn't. For example, I set the novel in a town which was entirely mythical, as far from my own experience as possible.